This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Art of Charm. Learn everything you need to know to crush it in business, love, and life.
Welcome to The Art of Charm. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Today, we're talking with my friend, James Altucher. He's a serial entrepreneur and author of several books, including Choose Yourself. And I've been on his show. He's been on mine. And he, as you guys know, if you're a fan of James, he's an interesting, quirky guy. And I ask him a lot of questions that make up those quirks. And I ask him some stuff that maybe, for a pretty open guy, some things that he might not normally think to divulge, not that he'd keep them a secret. And this was interesting. The way that I prepped for this show is instead of reading a bunch of stuff and taking a bunch of notes from stuff on the internet, I just asked our mutual friends a bunch of questions that they had about him and then fired away here. So enjoy this one with James Altucher. And with that, welcome to The Art of Charm. We bring together the best thought leaders, teachers, and exceptional individuals to teach you how to be a top performer in life, in your relationships, and at work. If you're new to the show, we'd love to send you some top episodes and the toolbox where we discuss things like body language, nonverbal communication, persuasion, networking, negotiation, mentorship, and everything else we teach here at AOC. In the U.S., just text CHARMED to 33444. That's CHARMED to 33444. Everywhere else, go to theartofcharm.com. We may not have all the answers, but we definitely have all the right questions. All right, here's James Altucher. I've noticed one thing that you do a lot of, and I think you're kind of known for this, is you share stories of failure pretty much all the time.
You think too much?
I don't think too much. I just think that it's obviously really important to you. I actually think it's probably not too much at all, because most of what people see out there, and I'm going to make fun of Gary Vee a little bit because I met with him yesterday, it's all like, you got to do this, you got to do that, I succeeded because of this. But very rarely do you hear someone go, let me tell you how I freaking lost like $10 million and cried myself to sleep and like became an alcoholic and was really depressed for like 3 years.
And the problem is, the reality is that's what happens to most people.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to write like personal improvement. I actually really want to be a writer and artistic about it. And I think to connect with people, you want to write about an experience you have that they also might have had. And I think most people experience that. And then maybe they succeed, maybe they don't. I'm just writing about my experience and what I've done to kind of come through it. I'm not really interested in the personal improvement industry. I'm not interested in slogans like telling people to go hustle or, you know, hustle and grind and, you know, think positive all the time. A, most of that stuff doesn't really work. You can't really say someone who's not hustling and you tell them, oh, go hustle. They're not like going to go just start
right.
Hustling.
No.
So like most advice doesn't work. Even if you're talking to your best friend and he's going out with someone or she's going out with someone who's cheating on them and they say or abusing them in some way. And you say, you know, you probably shouldn't go out with that person. Even your closest friend's not going to follow your advice. So why should random readers follow any advice? They just don't. So I always view advice as autobiography. So I tell my autobiography and then people can decide what they want to do with it. And I don't say my autobiography is important. I just say I'm probably experiencing something related to what you've experienced, I hope, because it's been pretty much a disaster for me. So maybe it's been a disaster for some other people. So I don't have to feel so bad all the time about it.
It's funny. It ends up being about you in a non-self-centered way. It's funny you should say your closest friend's not going to listen to your advice, because you see memes, which are a picture of a slogan on a picture of a guy like with his arms in the air in front of a beach, right? It's like, hustle and grind so you can be on top or whatever. That's not a real one, but it's not too far off. And you're right, a stranger's not going to listen to that. But you realize the people who post that stuff, they don't expect other people to actually follow that advice either. It just makes you feel good about, like, well, what are you doing to improve your business? Well, I follow these guys on Instagram, and every morning I wake up and I look at this poster that's inspirational. And then I talk a lot about grinding and resistance and people trying to bring me down. And so that makes me feel like I'm fighting against all that. And then I go to the co-working space and sit on Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat, and then I go home.
That's so true, because I think real success, I don't know how you define it. Let's define it the way most people do initially. Everybody denies that they define it this way, but the reality is 99% of people define it by how much money you make.
Sure.
It's so nuanced how you make money, and like how you've made money and how I make money. No one could probably even guess the real sources of how most people who make a lot of money made their money.
Sure.
And it's so nuanced in terms of, it's very psychological. Like, a lot of the times when I'm dealing with business, most of the time I'm talking with my partners, not about very specific, you know, hustling strategies, but I'm talking about the psychology of the people we're dealing with and how we negotiate with them, how we win them over, how do we work with them, who should we work with, who do we like that we want to work with. So it's very psychological. It's also about how do you get over the constant obstacles that are in the way. You need your landlord to agree to this. You need the head of sales secretary at this one company to agree to this. You know, there's all these obstacles every day that you kind of have to react to. People say, oh, don't be reactive, be proactive. That's true also. But again, the world of slogans is like 5% or 1% of how business works. And then there's real business.
Right. Yeah.
So, and nobody gets that until you're in a real business. Like, you have to get a customer. Most businesses don't live on venture capital welfare. They actually get customers, and that's really hard to sell, to make somebody part with their hard-earned after-tax money to buy something you've made that they didn't realize they needed. That's really hard to do.
It is. Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with anything on Instagram or Facebook. So I would never even dream to teach that, but I enjoy writing, and I enjoy also maybe kind of, I'd say, deflating a little bit these sort of motivational slogans and posters and everything, because I feel it's almost inhibiting people from finding happiness and success. And so now I'll broaden the definition of success a little bit by, like, okay, it's also good to not make the most amount of money on the block, to not have the biggest place in the block. Like you and I were talking about before this podcast, we were looking, you know, out the window is the late David Bowie's old apartment. And yeah, it's like this 3 or 4 story thing, just 50 feet away. You know, obviously it's just beautiful. It's incredible. It looks like it costs like $50 million. And we were talking about whether or not we would live there. Obviously, if I was given it for free, I would take it in a heartbeat. But if I had the opportunity to buy it and move in and spend the time and maintaining it and making it in my own, you know, fulfill my own wants and needs, I don't know if I would do it, because I like just living like a real simple life. Because I know if I'm happy with low expectations, you know, I'm going to be pretty happy in general.
I will say, though, that place is freaking rad.
Yeah, it looks awesome.
It is amazing.
It looks like if I could be Spider-Man and like shoot my web over there and just swing over right into a window, I'd really love to see the inside, like just to see what it's like.
It looks like if Tony Stark had to live in New York, he would live in that place.
Or like the top of the Fantastic Four building or something.
It's unbelievable. Spending the $50 million to pick it up and deal with it, it's a whole bunch of responsibility that it seems like, and I don't know why I get this feeling about you, but it seems like you wouldn't want.
I don't own and I don't rent. So I live.
Where do you live?
I tend to Airbnb or do kind of, let's call it, super couch surfing.
Okay.
So I've been doing business in New York for a really long time, let's say over 20 years. I know a lot of people. I have a lot of goodwill around the places where I go. So if I know someone's leaving for 6 months because he's got business in Germany and he has this enormous apartment in, you know, a great area, you know, I'll just outright ask, like, hey, can I stay there? And often I can. There's no one else staying there and they don't want to Airbnb because their place is precious. I always stay in great places, but right now I'm Airbnb-ing. I like an extended Airbnb. So the benefit of Airbnb is, here's the problem with renting in New York, is it's first month's rent, last month's rent, several security deposits, which you're never going to see again.
Guaranteed. DNA sample.
Yeah, practically a DNA sample. The last place I rented, I need 5 letters of reference. I needed a reference from 2 different business partners. I needed a letter from my accountant and a letter from my lawyer. And then I needed to go in and meet everyone in the building. So
what? That's so ridiculous.
There was only like 3 other people in the building, but I still had to meet them all. And I had to schedule appointments. It was up to me to schedule appointments with them and meet them. And they were all big shots in their field. So it was like very hard to do. And then they had to approve of me. And then any problem I had, like, let's say it was a Saturday night and I had the stereo on a little bit too loud, I would get phone calls, like, and I had to turn it down.
Oh my God.
You're locked in too for a long time. So what if you wanted to move to Florida for a month? What happened was, this was just really a few months ago, and I'd been kind of aiming in this direction. I kind of closed down a couple of leases that I had. I was renting an apartment upstate and an apartment here. I closed them down, didn't renew, and I hired somebody to go to both places while I was away. So she wasn't sentimental at all about my belongings. And I said, just throw out or donate or keep everything. Like, I don't want anything. And so I was left with one bag with about three outfits in it. Actually, not the outfit I'm wearing. I have since recycled the outfits. And one bag with computer, phone, and iPad. And that was my only belongings. And so now when I go to Florida for a month, I've moved to Florida for a month.
Yeah, you're there.
Now, though, because we're doing this podcast here, I actually, quote unquote, live around the corner from here. So convenience is very important to me, more than like the size of the place.
I agree with that. There's something about, and I don't know if it's just a creative thing in our brains, but if I live somewhere that's amazingly convenient to other things, I will do them. But if I live even 10 extra feet away from something, I won't do it. I won't go to the beach because it's seven stairs down this thing, and I will only eat at the same place because it's right there. I mean, that's just how I live my entire life somehow.
It's so funny because one time I was in Thailand at this island, Koh Samui. So
I've been there. Yeah.
It's a great place. It's beautiful. But it was really hot. It was August. So it was like 115 degrees outside.
Oh my gosh.
And I was finishing up a book. And I remember I went on Tim Ferriss's podcast and Tim's like, oh, you must be loving Thailand. And I'm like, yeah, I am loving it because I was sitting there writing my book, which I love doing. And he's like, how's the beach? And I said, well, I'm looking at it right now. It's about 15 feet outside of my apartment, but I haven't yet been there. And he's like, how long have you been in Thailand? I've been here 3 weeks already. And he started laughing too. Like, why haven't you been to the beach? And it was too hot. Like, I didn't want to go outside.
This might be my Jewish side, right? Where I'm just like, it's too hot. I don't want to schwitz. I'm in the AC.
It could be, but think about like this location. Again, for me, convenience is the most important thing. This is where I do most of my podcasts. So I live 50 feet away. Probably about 20 feet in that direction is one of my favorite bookstores in town. Over there, which is about another 100 feet, is my other favorite bookstore. So there's good restaurants right here. I never leave this one block area, at least right now, until I have to travel somewhere.
I don't think that's unusual for New York, though. I think it's pretty normal. I mean, there's a reason that each borough and neighborhood has a different name, and it's because you spend all your time there. People didn't really get on the subway to go out to eat and then go home. They just walked around and did it. If you worked, you got on the subway commute, but...
Well, we were just talking about the Wall Street area where it turned out by coincidence in 2009 and 2010, we lived in the exact same building.
That's crazy.
By coincidence.
I can't believe that. Yeah, you lived in the same building as Art of Charm in 2009, 2010.
I mean, I know for myself, I never left that area. Like, that was the area I was stayed put. But again, I think that's probably true about New York. And for me, I just have minimal expectations. Like, it's not like I really am eager to go to a show or go to some fancy restaurant. I'm just happy really just being as simple as possible. I think people think like simplicity and minimalism has to do with possessions, but it has to do with like everything in your life, not wanting as many things. For me, like a key to more contentment.
Do you think it's a key to some sort of creativity as well? Because it seems like you're really big on it. And I understand when you have less stuff to worry about, you want fewer things because you're actively getting rid of things. But why is that necessary for you, for example?
Happiness is a really hard thing to find, or contentment or well-being, whatever you want to call it. And I think if your expectations are really far from reality, then you're going to be constantly disappointed. Like if I expect everybody to like me, or if I expect to make $1 billion, or if I expect to get a job at Google, or expect to whatever, but the reality is just very far from there, then I'm going to be constantly unhappy. So you can almost think of it as like a math equation, like happiness is reality over expectations. So reality, I can't really change so much. I am what I am, or I can change it slowly, but expectations I can change right now. I can say, look, I just want a place that's very simple for me. I want to work on only the things I want to work on. I want to be around only the people I want to be around. And then it's very easy to suddenly jumpstart your happiness by lowering your expectations.
That's a really good point. So instead of trying to achieve different things, which you can also and should probably also do, you can also make things a little bit more quote unquote realistic, or at least it seems like evolving your goal makes a lot of sense. And for a lot of people out there, their goals don't even make sense for them. For example, they might want a really cool car and a really cool house and a really cool summer home and a boat, but they don't necessarily want any of that stuff for them. They end up being unhappy trying to achieve things that they think are going to make them happy, but that happiness would only come by other people's approval. So once you can kind of get rid of that and be like, yeah, I wear the same shirt and the same pants every day, and that's fine for me, you end up with this whole level of simplicity that makes it much easier to be happy. And it's not necessarily lowering the bar. You're just getting rid of what's extraneous to that.
Right. Because, for instance, I love to, in many areas of my life, I don't care what people think of me, by simplifying other things in my life. So I'm not like on, let's say, business calls all day. I'm able to focus on being as good a writer as I can be, like reading a lot, writing a lot, talking to other writers, doing these podcasts, which always kind of kickstart my creativity. And look, podcasts make a little bit of money. Writing makes a little bit of money. So eventually you build contacts in your industry from performing at a high level in that industry, and that can lead to other sources of income. So again, it becomes this nuanced way of making a living, as opposed to like, oh, I'm going to learn Google SEO and do the latest internet marketing and build this business that venture capitalists are going to fund until I sell it, and bam, which is a very unrealistic way of thinking.
It is. And I think it also relies on kind of what we were talking about before, which is like, you got to fit into one of those memes that's on Instagram. You've got to have multiple income streams, but passive, and you work on the beach and all that. And I'm curious about this because I think it's probably just maybe a quirk that I have that I need to let go of. When somebody sends you negative feedback about a blog post that you've written or a show, does it ever get under your skin, or do you just let it roll off?
It does get under my skin. And a lot of people say, oh, I don't care. And often I will say I don't care because it depends on the comment. Like,
yeah,
if you get like 100 bad comments by accident, one or two of them or 10 of them are going to hit those buttons that whatever would have hurt you at the age of 14 is probably going to hurt you now.
Yeah.
Like, we're always like that 14-year-old, like just becoming a physical adult. Your brain's just growing out in that way. So whatever you're insecure about then, you're probably going to be a little insecure about now. Yeah, it's going to hit those buttons. Not every time. Like, somebody will write something crazy, I'll just figure, okay, that's the one out of 10 who's not going to like my stuff. Because no matter what, 10% of people are just going to hate you. And yeah, maybe 30% of people are going to be neutral on you, even if you're the best in the world. And then, you know, the remaining 60% will have mixed feelings to really like what you do. So that 10% is always going to hate you. And you can say, okay, this is part of that 10%. But somewhere in that 30% of people who are on the fence, like, oh, you used to be good, but now it feels like you're blah, blah, blah. I think about it a little like, okay, do I need to improve? Do I need to listen to this? Or is this just random? It does affect me.
Yeah.
Like, I try to determine, is this going to be in the category of what I don't care about, or the category of like, okay, I need to listen to this a little bit?
Yeah, it's hard to make that determination because it's an emotional one. So often whenever I feel that like pluck of whatever it is under my skin and I'm like, I'm emotional, I do boomerang. You ever use boomerang for email? It's a tool. It's free. You can use it to snooze an email, among other things. And so I'll snooze that email for like a week or two. And then when it comes back, I'm like, oh yeah, I saw this. Was I really too hard on James Altucher? Was I really ill-prepared for this one or whatever? And then sometimes I'm like, yeah, I was. And then I can write back and go, thanks, you're right. Good observation. You must listen to the show really carefully, versus what I wanted to write in the moment, which was, F you have no idea how hard this is, you know, or whatever it is. And so I try to do that and go back with a clear head because I probably take it much more seriously than I probably should. So some negative feedback, I just don't care. It's like full of mistakes and misspelled words. And I'm like, okay, this person is like, it's not all there. The worst is an intelligently written piece of negative feedback because it's so hard to ignore that.
That's the worst. Like, I usually get that like once a year where someone will actually write a blog post and like trashing me, and they'll get some fact wrong, but of course that never matters.
Right.
So it gets like tweeted and retweeted and people will call me and I'll lose friendships. And this has happened.
Man.
And it's like this happened recently. I wrote to the person and said, you know, there's a lot of inaccuracies in what you wrote. You're affecting other people, not just me.
Yeah.
You're a lawyer. This person was a lawyer. You should probably take it down. And that person did realize, uh-oh, he's right. I'm damaging him. I'm going to take it down.
Yeah.
But then once something's syndicated out there, it like shows up on random sites. And so every now and then I have to write to the person and say, look, now it appeared on this site.
It's on Times of India or whatever that site is that like copies all your crap.
Right. Yeah. Some things will and some things won't. And you have to care sometimes because I want people to like what I do and I build up an audience. And I don't want people to look at wildly inaccurate information when they make their first judgment of me. And it is what it is. Like, most of the time, I don't really care what people think of my opinions because I'm never going to change my opinion to satisfy an audience. but I want people to like the things that I pour my soul into. I realize not everyone's going to like that, but I want people to like that.
Johnny, we know if you listen to the show, you are driven. In fact, we're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed.
Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster.
And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey.
Our hiring needs are broad in scope, and Indeed makes things easy and fast and organized. I don't know what we would do without Indeed.
Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every single day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets.
Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/charm. Just go to Indeed.com/charm right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Now let's get back to James Altucher.
It's tough because when you create stuff, and I think this is almost cliche, and you put yourself out there so much, especially the way you do it with all this vulnerability and things like that, and the amount of work that goes into, say, producing a podcast and stuff like that, to have somebody be like, yeah, you know, it's not, you're not good at it. Like, this is crap. Sometimes you're just like, whatever. But other times, you know, it depends on your mood. And I'm just kind of glad to hear that I'm not the only one who takes their craft, quote unquote, too seriously and lets it get to them sometimes, because I do know better. Right. And I have tons of ways to deal with it, but it doesn't mean that when something comes into the inbox, I'm not like, oh, ouch, wasn't ready for that today or whatever.
Yeah. Or like if, you know, let's say you're in a corporate environment, let's say you're in a cubicle in Procter & Gamble and one of your coworkers puts you down. You're going to be affected by it because we're tribal animals and that's the tribe you put yourself in. And every tribe in primate history has a hierarchy from alpha to omega. And if someone's putting you down, they're trying to force you down the tribe. And that's going to create this evolutionary response that just feels horrible. Like every neurochemical in your body is going to start firing, like you're under attack.
Stress and levels,
so,
yeah.
So if somebody who's not, who you don't care about so much, like they're way beneath you in the hierarchy or whatever, in whatever hierarchy you place yourself in, if they start attacking, you're like, whatever. But if someone who you can't tell or they're hitting the right buttons somehow is trying to like move you down, it blasts you.
It does, yeah. And I'll say that usually my biggest regrets come from the responses that I write if I do an emotional reply. Like, I don't know if this ever happened to you, but I think of these times where I fired something back and then I'm like, oh, I feel like such an idiot. And you'll get an email back from that person like, I really liked what you did, but I'm really annoyed now that you wrote this. And like, oh, you've lost some shine. And I feel like, oh, it just so burns. It's like disappointing one of your kids or something.
Yeah, what you see is what you get. The type of person I am in my writing, I want that to be me. So yes. Some of my writing is aspirational in the sense that I don't necessarily give advice, but I talk about situations I've been in, how where I've failed or where I've been miserable or where I've been dead broke and how I came back from that. And usually I came back from that by doing positive things in my life. And I want to still be that person. I want to be that person as much as possible, but it's really hard. Like you can't always be doing this positive thing, eating well, exercising. There's like 100 positive habits you need to be Superman.
Yes.
You can't do all 100 every day.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. Would you have any advice for somebody who's maybe working a regular job and is afraid to disappoint their boss and disappoint their family and disappoint their significant other? Because I feel like a lot of people that are personal development oriented or just successful or have potential, you know, for the youngins, we're always afraid of letting people down. And in the process, we let ourselves down a lot of the time.
I've talked about this before on my blog and my podcast and my books, and this is the key thing I always try to remember. The key thing is it's not about them. It's not about your spouse or your friends or your teachers or the government or your boss. It's always about you. So it's not that I'm afraid to disappoint them. It's that I'm not somehow secure enough in what I'm doing to be my own person. And so when I remember that, I say, okay, here's the checklist. I need to get back into that. And so the checklist is simply, the first thing is, am I physically healthy? Because if I'm sick, I'm always going to disappoint everyone. That doesn't mean being Superman at the gym and eating only broccoli, but it does mean, you know, eat pretty good, sleep 8 hours a day. Nobody in the world can only sleep 3 hours a day. There's all these people who claim, oh, I only need 3 hours of sleep. They're either lying or they're sociopaths, like it's impossible. So eat well, sleep 8 hours a day, and move, do some movement. Like, you can't get no exercise and expect your body to be totally healthy. Mm-hmm. So that's physical. Emotional, be around people you like and who you enjoy being around with and who are not toxic to you. Now, sometimes you can't be totally selfish. You have to be around people who you might want to help or you don't necessarily enjoy being around. But in general, try to be around people who are inspirational to you and you like and enjoy. And that's emotional. Creative. The creativity, I think of it as a muscle. And Stephen King writes about this in his book on writing. He got into a bike accident and was in bed for 6 months. And when he got out of bed and started writing again, he literally said he couldn't put two sentences. He couldn't two words together in a sentence. And that's Stephen King, who's, whether you like him as a writer or not, he's like the best-selling writer of all time almost, and incredibly prolific. But he said he literally couldn't write two words together. So creativity is a muscle you have to exercise every day. So every day I try to be creative in some way or other, whether it's writing or something else, usually writing or podcasting or whatever. And then the final thing is, be grateful. And I try to be grateful for difficult things. So it's easy for me to be grateful for children or whatever. But let's say you're in traffic in the city. We were just talking about traffic before the podcast. I could think to myself, oh man, I'm stuck in traffic. I'm going to be late for my meeting. That's complaining. Or you can be grateful and say, I'm in the most amazing city in the world. That's why everyone else is here. How great is it that I'm here? Always try to recognize when you're complaining and replace it with some gratitude. So those four things, physical, emotional, creative, gratitude, I try to check the box on those things at least once a day. And what I found was I've had some of the most horrible things happen to me, even in the past year and a half, 2 years. When those things happen, if I just get back to checking the box on those four things, I'll bounce back super fast.
Really?
And I always see it's faster and faster now each time.
It's like mindfulness, where if you meditate a lot, you can kind of zip back into it. But if you don't, it takes forever to shut everything out and do it. So it's like the gratitude habit, or looking for the positive habit versus trying to do it only when everything is down. It'll be really hard. But if you've been doing it for a year, you're good.
Mindfulness is a great example, because people say, oh, meditate, and that replaces, you know, there's all the science, meditation replaces antidepressants, or other people meditate because they want enlightenment. They call it enlightenment or whatever. Here's what meditation is. It's just, how do you catch yourself when you're thinking crappy things, so you stop thinking about them for a mini second? Like, that's all it is. Meditation is just training for the 15 minutes or 45 minutes or hour a day you meditate. Is just training for those other 23 hours where you might dwell on, oh, well, my boss said this, so I should say this, or I should say this. It's just training for those moments when your brain starts to cycle and you can get out of it and say, no, I'm going to be grateful because now maybe I hate my boss so much, I'm going to start looking for another job. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to just dwelling on how you should respond to him or something. So it has nothing to do with magic powers or enlightenment or depression. It's just, how do you get out of that dwelling that happens?
Now, you mentioned that in the past, and even now, your life is sort of dramatically changing all the time. Move to Florida, move over here, move down there, get rid of all your possessions, dive into this, eject forcefully out of that, whatever. Do you thrive on that, or do you find it exhausting? And why do you think that happens to you while most people just stay pretty routine?
I don't know. I've asked myself that question. I think I'm not really a big risk taker, but what ends up happening is I'm pretty stupid in a lot of areas.
Okay.
And so I take risks that I don't realize I'm taking. And sometimes good things happen and success results, and other times bad things happen and I have to figure out my way out of the hole I've just created. And so I think we all have different abilities to assess risk. I think nobody really wants to take huge risks. I think actually the most successful entrepreneurs will mitigate risks as much as possible. I think, again, you don't really fully know yourself until you attempt a little bit to get out of your comfort zone. Like, your comfort zone is this tiny little area inside your overall life zone.
Yes.
And so you don't really know what your life zone is, like what your potential is in life, until you're sort of punching your way out of your comfort zone. But you have to only go a little bit of the way each time. And maybe sometimes I go too far out of the way, or sometimes it's just life happens. Like, you might be involved in a business and it turns out something completely random happens, which it would have been really hard for you to mitigate that risk, and the business blows up and you have to figure out your way out of it. And then hopefully in the future, you've learned enough that you won't get into that same risk again. But there was no way for you to have known in advance this was a potential risk. And so I do take chances, and sometimes I know what the risks are and sometimes I don't, and then I get into trouble. And so chaos results, and I have to fight my way out of it. I think that's no different than anyone else. Look, you've been in these hostage situations where you had to get yourself out of it. Like, you didn't know what risks you were taking. You wouldn't willingly go into those situations. So I had a situation, this was about a year and a couple months ago. I was on the board of this company, and the company had $1 billion in revenues. But the largest shareholder owed, like, I don't know, some amount on his taxes. The bank found out about this, shut down our loan, which needed to pay employees. So the entire company basically disappeared within 4 days, like $1 billion revenue company.
Wow.
And the bank came in and took over and sold bits and pieces to other companies. So nobody lost their jobs. But I, as a shareholder, a major shareholder, lost an enormous amount of money. And normally that would have just like destroyed me for a year. At that moment, it was an emergency board meeting. I was at something else. You've had Brian Koppelman on your podcast. So I was on the set of Billions, the TV show Billions.
Awesome.
Yeah. And so Brian had invited me, and I was watching the premiere episode of season one being filmed. Damian Lewis, all these famous people were there. And I was learning so much and I was having a great time. Then I get this text, emergency board meeting, get on the phone right now. So I disappear for an hour. I find out I'm about to lose this enormous life-changing amount of money. And then I have to go back for the next 6 hours to enjoy what's like one of the best days of my life being on the set of this TV show. And I was able to do it. And afterwards, I told Brian the story, and Brian was like, whoa, we didn't even realize you were just happy and asking questions and laughing with everyone else. We thought you had just gone to the bathroom for a long time.
Oh my God.
And so I realized that following this practice I do does allow me to bounce back quickly, because look, life's short. When am I going to be on the set of my favorite TV show again? And, you know, I wasn't going to spend that money anyway during my short lifetime. So you just have to kind of like realize what's important to you at every given moment and stick to some practice, some code that you're going to live by and really be serious about.
It's amazing that a company like that can go away overnight. It must have been an enormous amount of money owed to the government and like a criminal level of liability.
Right, which
tax.
Is why I won't even get specific about it, because it's all alleged still.
Sure.
But it's, you know, the one thing is every board member was called in to talk to various officials. I was the one board member not called in.
They're like, this guy doesn't know squat.
And
don't bother.
Like, you know, the law firm was like, we got to prepare you, so send us all your emails. And so I sent them like 200,000 emails. And then I go in to the law firm and it's a bunch of people and they're asking me all these questions. And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, you know what? You have to know something, because otherwise there's another problem.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, well, here are the things I do know. So I did know enough that there's not a problem, but I knew so little about the mechanics of what happened, you know, underneath, that like that wasn't the reason I was on the board to have anything related to what happened. But
you're like a trophy wife on the board. There's this, he gave us a bunch of startup capital. He's been pretty much useless ever since then.
I was useless in terms of the mechanics of the business.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, what I would do is like just how they presented themselves to the public. I helped them a little bit with that. But otherwise, I had no clue at all.
That is so funny when you tell the story like this. Speaking of risk, though, don't get mad at Jenny Blake, but she told me that you mitigate risk in some kind of strange ways. And you do this a lot, even in your personal life. Jenny Blake, author of Pivot, super nice woman, amazing, super friendly and cool. She said you guys went to a movie and you had like bought duplicate tickets or something in case the Fandango machine didn't work.
So Jenny, author of Pivot, book comes out September 6th. She's got a great podcast. We were going out with like four or five of our friends. And I know when anyone asks me to a movie, I've just got to make sure everything goes okay. It's like a weird thing with me. And I've never had to take advantage of this. And so they kind of caught me and it almost was weird. But we get there and it turns out the tickets they bought like five or six tickets. The tickets they bought were for the next day's showing.
Oh, I've done that before.
Yeah. So we're all going to be disappointed. I really wanted to see the movie. So I knew in advance, I really wanted to see the movie. I know there's always a 1 in 1,000 chance someone's going to mess up. So I bought 6 tickets for the same show in advance, just in case. And I wasn't going to use them, and I wasn't going to embarrass myself by telling them I bought these tickets until we weren't allowed in. And they were all like thinking, oh no, what are we going to do? And I was like, listen, everybody,
ta-da,
I have one possible solution if you want to make use of this. And so we did. Not only that, we got like tickets reimbursed so we can go to another movie. We're all planning on another movie at some point. But yeah, I tried to, you know, I'll do this in many cases, like restaurant reservations and movie tickets, all small things. But, you know, I've done it as far as like plane reservations and so on. But in general, I tried to take the risk out of any situation. But I felt like then they thought it was so weird. Like they were asking me about it afterwards. It was almost embarrassing, the fact that I like saved the movie experience.
It's like, what, you don't trust us? Granted, you shouldn't have trusted us because we blew it. But like, what the hell, man? You didn't know that.
Anybody can make mistakes. So I figured, you know what? Just in case, I'm going to buy the tickets also.
Restaurants, movies, I get it. But with planes, are these things you can't always cancel and get reimbursed? And you're just like, this is insurance for this because I really need to get to this Oscar party. I don't want to miss it. I bought 2 plane tickets on 2 flights.
Yeah. And it might be exactly an Oscar party.
Yeah.
So I did that for an Oscar party.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What a guess.
Elton John's Oscar party.
Nice. Yeah. Because if you miss the flight, it's like, I need to get to LA. And they're like, whatever, bro. And then you just miss the Oscar party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I'll do that with, if I have friends coming in from out of town, like hotel rooms, because sometimes hotels will fill up in weird ways, or you won't like one hotel and you need another. So, and I try not to spend too much money on this, but it has helped me a lot. It's added to my quality of life, the little bit I've spent on this.
I think that makes a lot of sense, especially if you can calculate something where you can get reimbursed. Like, it only costs you a little bit of time to make a duplicate restaurant reservation. It only costs you a little bit of time to get duplicate movie tickets because you can always get those kind of refunded unless they're being totally unreasonable.
Even a restaurant might have a cancellation fee, but it might be like $10 per guest or something like that.
I feel like New York's the only place that has cancellation fees for reservations just so that you don't have a no-show.
But like, let's say you're going on a date, right? And you find a great place and you get there and somehow something messed up. Okay, don't worry. There's the other great place one block away where I also have a reservation. Oh, I even go further. I'll go there in advance and introduce myself to the hostess or host or whatever. And I'll even plan like a joke. Like one time I was going to meet someone at a place and this was a date situation. I went there an hour in advance. The hostess was from a completely different background than me in every way. Like you would look and clearly like we wouldn't know each other at all. We made a whole plan where I would go in with my date and this woman would say to me, oh my God, James, I haven't seen you in forever. And I would say, Leticia, how's your mom doing? This is incredible. And the date was like, you two know each other? Like, this is my cousin. And we never broke character for the whole evening. But it's worth it to kind of plan these things in advance because there's fun you can do with it as well. It not only mitigates risk, but there's fun you can have.
That's really funny. Yeah. And of course, so you get the added bonus of, look, I'm making a duplicate reservation. Worst case scenario, it's going to be a funny joke.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Worth it every time.
With Kizik hands-free shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy-on, easy-off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. For a list of all the amazing sponsors and discount codes, visit theartofcharm.com/advertisers. Now, back to James Altucher. You do share a lot of failures, and you're very detailed in your thought process, which I think is really, that's the helpful part about sharing failures.
Well, I think a lot of people say, oh, I failed, and then they focus on, but now I'm like an all-star basketball player. But people really want to know the details of the failure because A, there's a voyeuristic aspect of it. B, they relate to it more when you give the actual specific details. That's what storytelling is about, is getting the details. And I don't know, they want to take pleasure in your failure too.
Does that ever make you feel a little bad? I can't believe I'm admitting this, but I might as well. Sometimes when people who are successful, even if I'm rooting for them to kill it and helping them do it, there's a part of me that I'm very ashamed of, and it's a small part, thankfully, where if something doesn't work out, I'm like, oh good, I still stack up well against this person. And it's like such an annoying, shameful part of my competitive nature.
Yeah, the only reason I think people do that with me, that same thing, is someone on Quora, I think it was, asked, why do you like James Altucher? He's so annoying. And someone wrote, he's like the light at the end of the tunnel. Like, you could be in like a really bad, dark tunnel, but James shows that just by writing about it, that there is a way out usually. It doesn't matter like how bad it gets. Someone could die. You could lose all your money. You could get divorced. You know, you have ups and downs in terms of what you are as a person. But yeah, at the end of the day, you can come out, even fall and fail again. I now have a little bit more confidence that I'll come out of it. Like this experience just 14 or 15 months ago.
Oh, that was that recent.
So it's while I was writing about previous financial failures, I had like an enormous financial failure. Now I'm old enough and I've come back enough that I do well. I have like the classic multiple, you know, sources of assets
Diverse, and so on.
But this was a big source and it completely fell apart. But it didn't really affect my life at all because I have a skill set of coming back from these things.
You probably don't even do this because it might just be depressing to like look at all the ups and downs. Do you ever revisit that stuff or is it just it's over and you don't think about it anymore?
I revisit it because I want to understand what happened and not make the same mistakes again. You're always the same person at heart. So it's very possible to make the same mistakes again. People intellectually think they know what they did when they make a mistake. But the reality is often it's very subconscious in ways that would surprise you if you really knew. You need to do deliberate practice about yourself.
Yeah.
Like, so you need like a mentor or a coach or something, or read a lot of biographies and so on. And you need feedback on how you're doing, feedback from people who are outside of you who might see these subconscious things happening with you again. You need to constantly be thinking about improvement because that is how you improve. You're not going to improve by accident. You're going to have to work at it.
Are you more comfortable learning from failures than wins in some way?
Well, think about any sport or game. And you've interviewed high performance athlete coaches. The main way you learn is from failure.
Yes.
So for instance, I am a very good chess player. Like I'm a, you know, ranked chess master.
You have chess player hands.
Yeah, I have chess player. That's what my daughter told me.
Oh, is it really?
We went to a park and some guy wanted to play and I sat down and played and she took the photo and like both of us had like kind of this hair all, yeah, all crazy. But if I win a game, I think to myself, oh, of course I won that game. I'm a genius. But if I lose a game, that's when you're like, what did I do wrong? When you go over every single move, you run the move into the computer, you look at books. Here's where Kasparov, Karpov veered off of what I did. Why did they veer off from what I did? And you think about every move and you go over with an instructor. The instructors only want to see the failures. And you see like every world champion in history, they totally examine their failures. They'll write books about their failures just because that's how that helps them to understand. Mm-hmm. Or like one world champion in the 40s and 50s, Mikhail Botvinnik, he would play these practice matches where someone would blow smoke in his face during the game. And he hated smokes and he hated smoking. So he would put him in the most negative situation possible so he could learn to be good in these negative situations. And that's not like chess is high performance athletics, but you still have to play at a high performing level intellectually and mentally and even physically. I mean, the best players now do work out in a gym because you have to be physically strong and have stamina. You know, so you always learn in general from failures. But in real life, it's the same thing. It's all a game. So A, you don't take things personally. And B, it helps you to understand this is how people learn in games. You do the same things in real life.
That smoke thing is like the chess equivalent of in the army, they're like shooting blanks off over your head while you're crawling through mud and under the barbed wire. Or when you're running along the balance beam and they're hitting you with like pugil sticks to try to knock you off.
Or in law school, right? You had to like argue in front of fake courts because you want to know what it feels like to have that adrenaline level while you're playing or while you're arguing in court. You could only do that if you really picture it in advance, if you practice it in advance, if you study it afterwards. Like this is what improvement's about, is kind of examining your failures. You get feedback from failure. You don't really get feedback from a win because you don't know where it was that you suddenly won, but you really do want to know where it was that you failed. So this is a big stock market thing. everybody thinks in an up market that they're a genius and that they know how to make money and they can mint money. And then when the stock market falls, they're like, oh my God, it's my broker's fault, or it's the government's fault, or it's the Democrats' fault, or the Republicans' fault. They always want to blame someone else because they thought they were a genius when things were going well. But you have to always assume, I'm not a genius when things are going well, but I'm going to learn when things are going poorly. It's always my fault when things are going poorly.
It's like extreme ownership. If you look at Jocko, you know, Jocko Willink is a Navy SEAL. He wrote this book, Extreme Ownership.
Where, I like that title.
And it's just what it sounds like. It's whenever anything goes wrong, it's always some part your fault. So you have to figure out what that fault is. Even if the fault is you hired somebody who's not up to the task and you didn't train them well, or you weren't paying attention to what the higher ups were doing enough such that you could prevent the problem from trickling down to your level or whatever. I mean, there's always some aspect.
Oh my God, that's so true. I'm going to read that book because I'm in a situation right now where I'm in a lot of involved with lots of different business activities and writing activity and so on. But I have one situation which is a little bit negative. And I'm like thinking to myself, why is it negative? What did I do? And what I did was maybe four or five layers of life removed. It had to do with some other relationship I had, which trickled over. And I didn't make that connection. I wouldn't have made that connection unless I really thought about it. Everything you do has consequences. And so if something has a negative consequence, you can't keep it isolated from other areas of your life. Like if I'm having an argument, let's say one of my children, that might have a negative consequence on a business situation. Like maybe I was arguing so much, it threw me off my game on a business meeting a day later. And then 6 months later, they asked me, well, why did you miss that plane? Or why did you cancel speaking at this conference? And it all has consequences. It all trickles around. So you kind of, it's not that positive thinking is important. I don't believe in that at all. But taking this extreme ownership, I just love that phrase, is really important, and trying to be positive in as many areas of life as possible, trying to improve, because recognizing that you can't compartmentalize, there's no such thing. Every part of your life is connected to every other part of your life. Being strong with your network, because how you treat one person is going to affect how you treat the other 30 people in your life, and so on. Like, all these things are important.
What's the lesson from your failures that you still have yet to learn? And I don't mean the one that you can't see, but like an alcoholic who knows he needs to stop drinking, but just won't do it. What's the lesson that you're like resisting?
I think I do have somewhat of an addiction to drama. So as much as I intellectually say, I don't want any drama in my life, I want things to be simple, I'm going to get rid of all my possessions, I'm going to live simply, almost like monk-like, I think some part of me gets extremely frustrated or unhappy or bored. I get attracted to situations that are a little bit more dramatic, or I get allow myself to get sucked into them, thinking that I'm going to have some sort of pleasure out of them. And that has consequences. So by pleasure, I don't necessarily mean like I'm going all over the place, taking drugs and having sex with hookers. It could mean anything.
Have you ever had no money? I don't know if you've had like no money.
I've had no money. I've had like negative money is a joke. Because if you have negative money, that's actually better than having no money.
It is.
Because it usually means there's some negotiation. If you have negative money, that means you owe somebody. And then there's a negotiating tension that you could monetize somehow.
Interesting.
But having zero money is the worst, because then nobody cares at all.
Right. You're invisible, right?
Right. And so yes, I've had situations with no money. And then people really do not care. And you realize quickly, all the people you thought would care do not care at all. And you really have to figure out, what am I going to do? I have two kids. I need a place to live. I used to have a lot of money. Now I have zero. I don't even have negative. I have zero. And I've got to figure out how to live, because no one else is going to figure it out for me.
You've had tons of money, no money. And I got to put this in air quotes, normal lifestyle. Like now, it's not normal at all for most people, but
Yeah, I would say, by the way, I don't think I've had a normal lifestyle for about 20 years. So I quit my last corporate job August 31st, 1997. I haven't had a normal lifestyle since then. Because when you run a business, say, it's 24 hours a day. You can't leave. As you know with the podcast, it's not like you can leave the work in the office. Like, you're no longer a civilian going to work with the other civilians. And I don't say this in a negative way. I think it's great to be a civilian, have a good life. But you're no longer a civilian. You're now threw yourself out there into this much larger, much more complicated world. And whether your life is negative or positive, it's not normal at all.
So you've had tons of money, yet had no money, had a baseline stable lifestyle, I should say, like now. And we all know lots of people probably in all these different scenarios. Where were you the most happy and content? and the most sane at the same time.
I mean, this sounds like a cliche, but I am the most normal, happy, content, and sane right this moment. So, and it sounds like a cliche because that's, I feel like I've even heard people say that.
It's almost like you're supposed to say.
Right. But look, I'm really enjoying this, doing these podcasts with you. We've hung out a couple of times, but this is like the most extended time
we've
talked. I'm doing well financially. I'm doing well in not 100% of my relationships, but most of them. I'm really happy right now. So, and my expectations are incredibly low. So I could die tomorrow and I'm happy with that too. So
nice.
It's a problem when you tell people that. Like I would tell, let's say the girl I'm seeing, I would say, oh, I'm happy if I die tomorrow. And she'd get really upset. The only one I don't really tell to is my kids. They would get really upset if I said, yeah.
They would be pretty sad. Yeah, I think so. Where were you the most excited for the future with lots of money, no money, or stable?
The first time I sold a business, I was super excited about the future. I was like, man, this business worked. I'm a genius. I'm going to keep making a ton of money. I'm going to be a billionaire at some point. I wasn't even thinking about like right now, like I should have just been enjoying right then, which I never did. I never celebrated the fact that I sold this business. And for the first time in my life, I had more than $0 in the bank. I had actually like a significant amount of money in the bank. And I immediately said, I'm such a genius because of this. So I poured all that money into other investments and other huge purchases. Of course, I almost immediately lost all of it. It was like $15 million cash, went to zero. I'm not bragging about it because I went to zero from that. $0. I remember at one point I went to the ATM and I had $143 in the bank. And I'm thinking, like, what am I going to do? I have no source of income. I had already jacked up all my expenses. I had no clue what was going to happen. But when I sold that business, I thought the future has no end. And I think this is why, you know, if you look at like billionaire investments, billionaires are obsessed with anti-aging companies.
Yeah.
Because it's like really great to have $1 billion.
Sure.
So you don't want it to end.
Ever.
So you just invest in, oh, if I just inject myself with like the stem cells of a 3-month-old baby all the time, I'm going to be perpetually young. And they research this stuff and they spend hundreds of millions researching this. It actually is really great to have $1 billion.
Yeah.
So I don't understand that exact feeling, but I can get it. And because they want to look forward to a future of constantly having $1 billion for hundreds of years. You know, now I avoid looking forward to anything in the future. I'm really happy right now. And my mistake back then, if I'm learning from my failures, my mistake was focusing too much on a future that never existed.
I think that's an important realization. I think a lot of people maybe come to that when they're dying. Again, a cliche, crap, I never thought about what I was doing right now.
Oh, yeah. It's like kind of like the rest of the dying. I wish I had done what I really wanted to do, or I wish I had spent more time with my friends. Mm-hmm. Or that's almost a cliche, too. But it's so true that, look, spend time with people you like and do what you want to do. And people say, well, I can't do that. I have to take care of the kids in the morning and then I got to like pay the mortgage. So I got to work the 9-to-5 job. I get it. I always tell people, start writing down 10 ideas a day. So this will start exercising that creativity muscle, that idea muscle. You won't have a good idea. So write 10 bad ideas a day. And maybe after 6 months, your idea muscle will be exercised enough and you'll start to come up with good ideas that can help you get out of this situation. But you won't know until you do it every single day for 6 months. You have to exercise that muscle.
Nice.
So it's really important. And it's what I had to do. So when I first went broke, this was like in 2000, starting around June of 2002, I did start exercising this idea muscle. And by 2003, let's say 6 months later, I had started to figure out for the first time in years, money was coming in, opportunities were happening. I had made a complete shift in careers. Lots of things happened because this idea muscle started being exercised. And I make sure I still, to this day, do that every single day.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you that you want to make sure you deliver, like the bit of wisdom that you're like, I can't believe you didn't ask me this. Come on.
No, this was great. You know what people should do is also listen to you on my podcast, The James Altucher Show, because that was a fascinating podcast. So your listeners who don't know every single thing about you, I think we covered some stuff.
Yeah, we did.
Probably you didn't even cover on your own podcast.
I agree. I'll link to that in the show notes of this episode. So
excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Jordan.
Thank you. Interesting show. You know, he never disappoints. He's had a lot of money. He's had no money. He's had normal lifestyles. He's had the lifestyle that he's designed for himself now, which is anything but normal. An interesting guy to learn from in terms of his success and, more importantly, his failures, as he is so open about them. And I hope you enjoyed this one. Don't forget, you can thank James on Twitter. We'll have that linked in the show notes, as well as other resources and books mentioned on the show. You can tap our album art in most of your mobile podcast players to see the cheat sheet, the show notes for this episode right on your phone. I'm also on Twitter. I'm at The Art of Charm. Great place to engage with me there. Post a lot of stuff there as well. Boot camp and live program details for our live residential programs here at AOC. Check it out at theartofcharm.com. Remember, we sell out a few months in advance. So if you're interested, or you may be interested, or you're kind of thinking maybe someone else is interested, get in touch ASAP, get some info from us, plan ahead. And don't forget about our Art of Charm challenge at theartofcharm.com/challenge. Or if you're here in the States, you can text CHARMED to 33444. That's CHARMED to 33444. We're created this little mini online course. It's about improving your networking and connection skills, inspiring those around you to develop personal and professional relationships with you. And we'll also email you our fundamentals toolbox that I mentioned earlier on the show. I've also got regular videos with drills and exercises to help you move forward. It'll make you a better networker, a better connector, and a better thinker. That's theartofcharm.com/challenge, or text CHARMED here in the U.S. to 33444. This episode of The Art of Charm was produced by Jason DeFilippo. Jason Sanderson is our audio engineer and editor, and the show notes on the website are by Robert Fogarty. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. And go ahead, tell your friends, because the greatest compliment you can give us is a referral to someone else, either in person or shared somewhere on the web. So stay charming and leave everything and everyone better than you found them.
Thanks for listening to The Art of Charm. Get more confidence, relationship skills, life hacks, and more at theartofcharmpodcast.com.